Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Hello, so it's episode 4 of our lockdown series, and also episode 4 of the Sunderland Side Eye Watch-Alongs. As you'll know by now, this is an FPL-free zone, but if not, hello and welcome. Now please stop listening to this and go back to episode 1 of the series, starting off at 18 minutes 30 to get up to speed. For those still with us, hello. We're joined today by Nick and Stag, of course. Nick, first, you're all right, having a few sound difficulties and looking like a woodsman, but I hope you're back and able to join us for this podcast.
Hey, man. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Just enjoying lockdown life. Getting very samey at the moment, but yeah, enjoying watching a bit of Sunderland Till I Die, still doing the weekly podcast, so some things haven't changed. So here we are. We are Who Got The Assist. You can find us on Twitter at WGTN_FPL. Tom at myself, WGTA underscore Nick at FPL Stag for Anthony. And we're also on Instagram, WGTA.FPL. So what's on the pod this week, Anthony?
Hey lads, how you getting on? Bit like that for me as well, Nick. Just another week of the same. Probably had my lockdown dip last week and I'm kind of coming back out of it again this week after another episode of Sunderland Till I Die in the belt, I guess. So first of all, we'll start with the news, which football's return actually seeming a bit more like a reality than a dream, finally. And yet another Premier League player has joined the ranks of Jack Grealish and Kyle Walker, being splashed across the front page of the tabloids for coronavirus rule and discretion. So that's fantastic. And having spoken, I guess, about Charlie Methven and making so many comparisons to The Office, this time we're with season 2, episode 4, playing poker. We really have an office-based episode of Sunderland Till I Die. So a pretty interesting episode overall to look at. So many talking points again.
It's definitely a lot more interesting than that sounds. I'm aware that putting it as an office-based episode is one of those things, but no, it genuinely is like the episode, I think, of the season. So yeah, can't wait to get into that. But first, it is the news views. And yeah, I mean, before we came on this evening, I was about to say for this bit that there was a hardening of views, you know, and people were starting to, the momentum was starting to go behind right off the season. I saw a few articles and a few kind of opinion pieces, admittedly on Twitter, saying, you know, well, there's no point in starting a new season again, it's all over, it's just Liverpool fans who are being placated to and the money men are going to win. Lo and behold, BBC Sport announced a project restart is being looked at. A top club's meeting on Friday, and the 8th of June, potential start is being mooted, all behind closed doors, of course. What do you think of this?
I definitely feel like there's been a bit of a sea change, hasn't there, in the last week. From the beginning of the week, we had obviously the news about Holland and their league being suspended. We've already talked about previously on the last pod, the Scottish league being suspended. So a lot of the smaller leagues, you know, the smaller leagues in Europe, looking to write off the season, whilst these are the main big leagues, La Liga, Bundesliga, Serie A and the Premier League. It looks to be the opposite, and they are going to continue on and play the football through right or rain, and it's going to happen. The main event's going to happen. I mean, ultimately, we have discussed this on the last few pods. It's kind of a weekly news, obviously. Where is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? It does feel like it's probably now going to be happening. And to be honest, in a summer where there's not going to be any other sports on, at least it's going to give any us fans something to watch if it does take place and we do go ahead. I think we've talked in depth about how we felt that it was going to be quite unrealistic to achieve, considering we're still in the midst of a massive pandemic and doesn't look like lockdown is going to be ending anytime soon still. But the money will talk eventually.
So what the league are hoping to do is to get an 8th of June restart, which would mean finishing the season by the end of July. And that's all to fit into, remember, UEFA's European plans that we were talking about previously with the August extravaganza thing. Yeah, and so this is basically to try and fit that in. So this would be hoping that basically teams can get back to training in mid-May. I think the 18th of May has been kind of identified. But of course, we've already seen some of the clubs going into training individually. So Arsenal are back training individually, as are West Ham and Brighton. They've opened up their training grounds to players to train. Now, what's interesting about the Arsenal thing is that it's a bit of a misnomer to say they're back training. They're certainly not training as a squad. It's in their individual groups, and they're using 12 pitches and only leaving a certain number of players in whilst they're there. But basically the idea of opening the Colony training ground is that it's safer than a park for the players to exercise in. That the players had terrible, no, this is serious, that the players had terrible trouble with fans coming up trying to get selfies with them when they were trying to stay fit in parks. So the easiest thing to do was to open Colony, basically as a player safety thing.
Oh wow, really? Is it not like Ndombele and Sessegnon training on the field somewhere? It's a little bit different if it's Arsenal players, obviously. But yeah, no, it's definitely interesting. Yeah.
Pepe have been up to no goody.
That's true. I think Lacazette was too close to somebody who was valeting his car. Yeah, well, that's the sort of story you get down Arsenal these days. But yeah, no, Arsenal players, as Stag said, are training in some ways. They're all arriving in groups of five to do individual sessions. Yeah, they're using lots and lots of pitches. Each player is being assigned their own ball, and players on a rota and been told where to park as well. And lots of buildings at the training ground are closed. So it's a return to training in some ways. And with those sort of words, you get that little tingle of excitement. But I think the reality is that it's a return to training in name only. It's not quite the same as saying they're back to full contact. If you think about a player coming back after a long injury and they're doing some individual work, that's the kind of level of thing we're looking at, I think, here.
In stark contrast then to the Premier League are the plans in Germany, where the equivalent of the Football League there, which runs both the Premier League and what we would know as the Championship in England, so the top two divisions, they're looking to be ready to return to play on May the 9th, pending government approval. So it kind of seems like football will return to Germany at some point in May, as opposed to that May 9th date, which just seems to be kind of an ambitious head start, really. But the one thing to remember when it comes to Germany is that they're much further ahead of most other large European nations in terms of this whole virus pandemic thing, in that they've kept deaths down, their health system hasn't been really overloaded from the start of this, and they actually have surplus testing at the moment as well, which is something that most countries would be dreaming of. Like, even they're carrying out quite a lot of the Irish tests. When we had a backlog at one point, we were sending them to Germany. So basically the idea with how they're going to run the Bundesliga is having spectator-free games, obviously, where only players, coaches, and the staff of the teams, medics, referees, ball boys, ground staff, technicians, safety officers, and production staff for the TV will be present in the stadium. So that's about 300 people in a stadium is what they've kind of worked out will be the minimum. And what you'll also have then is the players and management being tested between trainings and before matches. It'll require 20,000 tests per week, which is 0.5% of all of German testing ability. Oof. So pretty amazing, but that's the cost of running Football League in these times.
Vorsprung der Technik, eh? Also, there's another development, wasn't there, Nick, this week?
Yeah, it's a proposal from FIFA to support teams and help the players cope with the upcoming fixture congestion as they try and complete the league as quickly as possible ahead of, obviously, a new season starting. And that's the plan, to allow up to 5 substitutions in a game. So increasing from 3 to 5, obviously, this would also require approval from the International Football Association Board and the Premier League before it would be enacted into the Premier League. But it was quite interesting to think about how that might have an impact as well on fantasy if it was ever to return for us. Obviously, the idea of 5 substitutions might mean more players being substituted before that famous 60-minute mark, and more captain blanks, perhaps, or one-pointer captains, players coming off the bench to block other players. So, yeah, that would be very interesting to see how that works out for us as well.
Yeah, Okay, and speaking of things, how things work out, Alan Pardew, the luckiest manager in the world, he could have been relegated again, but with that Dutch league call-off, he was saved by the looks of it. 7 points from safety with my birth team, ADO Den Haag. This only comes to mind today because he was forced to deny he was going to get a €100,000 bonus for avoiding relegation. And finally, Moise Keane, keen to have a party by the sounds of it. Another player who's been in the news for all the wrong reasons, as Stag mentioned earlier on, in the front pages, and Everton not very happy with his antics, are they?
No, I think he is. And it's a painting football really in a bad light, but ultimately that's what the tabloids do, isn't it? They like to find the worst stories possible that footballers have committed and publish it on the front of their newspapers. So there's not too much more to say about that, is there?
Certainly not. So let's move from bad stories to good stories and go to season 2, episode 4 of Sunderland Till I Die after this break.
Who got the assist?
Right, so we're back and it's season 2, episode 4 of Sunderland Till I Die, Playing Poker. Pretty much the episode of the series, because I think there are lots of tumultuous events in this one which really define how the season is and will live long in the memory. But this episode, the scene opens and really, we're thrown straight into the deep end, aren't we, of Josh Madger signing for Bordeaux. There's a voiceover as well from Stuart, who actually seems rather shocked at the events, or at least expresses astonishment at how things transpired.
Negotiating with Josh, it's all moving along. Jack calls me and said Josh has come in and picked up all his stuff and said he's gone. And I said, well, hold on a minute, I haven't accepted anything.
Then that €1.5 million, and he makes the point that this means nothing compared to promotion.
But €1 million... isn't worth anything in comparison to promotion.
I mean, that's a huge deal, isn't it? That really just smacks us in the face as soon as the episode starts. Like, what do we think about this? What's the detail behind the deal? And Anthony, you've had a look into it.
Yeah, so there are quite a lot of reports about how this kind of came to be, in that when Stuart Donald took over Sunderland in the summer, Josh Madger hadn't really been identified as a key player for that team, and so he was still on less than £1,000 per week at the time. And there had been hopes, or Martin Bain had wanted to tie down the player in May 2018. That never happened, and there were attempts to resume contract negotiations in July, which it seems the club actually pushed back and wanted to wait and see what happened. And so by the time they'd actually made their first offer of a contract to Madger in October, he'd already scored 9 goals in the league that season. And he was offered £2,750 a week, rising to just under 5K per week if they got promoted. Obviously, at this point then, what Donald later describes as the perfect storm kind of arises, and he just keeps on scoring, and so they keep having to up their offers to him. In November, they offer 5,000 a week, rising to 7.5K, which Madger's team actually countered with an offer of, they wanted 8,000 per week with a £3.5 million buyout clause. And when you think about how the season came to play out, that looks like it would have been a steal for the club, but at the time it was too much for them to go for it.
Yeah, as we're saying off camera, £8,000 a week versus promotion, effectively. I mean, yeah, 24 appearances, 15 goals, what Madger scored before he left. I mean, replacing that guy, as Eddie McGeady says a little while later, is a very, very difficult, very bitter pill to swallow for the guys. And, you know, it's been bubbling away beneath the first three episodes. We have mentioned it a few times. Indeed, episode 2 ended with Madger looking a bit suspicious. Episode 3, he was amongst the people and kind of giving them false hope, as it were. But, I mean, it really just seems to have fallen away. And, you know, the money that he's on at Bordeaux, you can't really argue with that, can you?
No, so L'Équipe report that he's on about £57,000 a week at Bordeaux, or €65,000 a week, which is obviously a huge jump on anything that Sunderland were offering, or anything that they were even looking for from Sunderland. But what's actually the most interesting thing is that when Bordeaux came in to make the transfer for him, they were quite happy to do a Bosman, which would have meant he would have signed for them at the end of the season, as opposed to in January. But Sunderland decided, right, we just want to make some money off him now, and took the £1.5 million while it was on offer for them. But the club actually were entitled to about £500,000 because he was a young player being taken on a Bosman. So they only really gained about £1 million from it and lost probably promotion.
Yeah, I did find it interesting, really. You don't see much at all of Josh Maguire in this episode, because he's obviously such a, you know, critical part of the past few episodes. It's just the introduction, that's the end. That's the end of Maguire. The club's moving on, they've forgotten about him. But yeah, I mean, looking at Stuart, you see him, and he's spoken to Jack Ross and said that he hasn't accepted anything. But apparently, you know, Maguire's just left. He's just picked up his stuff and has gone. And in terms of Stuart, it does look like, you know, he's a little bit out of control, and we're going to talk a lot more in depth about Stuart later on in this, because he's such a critical part of this episode and his dealings. But it does seem like he's lost a little bit of control of this situation. He didn't necessarily need to sell Maguire, but Maguire's taken matters into his own hand. It's player power here. He's gone, he's decided, he's moving on. The chairman, at least how he tries to present it, can do nothing now about this scenario. The player's gone. And the club has to move on.
Yeah, I mean, this early sort of stark realisation that, yeah, that key man is out of there, I think really sets up this episode incredibly well, because it is like something, as I mentioned earlier, that had been bubbling away for the first three episodes. As the guy said, there's lots of reasons why that's happened, and how the impacts on Stuart is kind of what this episode's all about, and that really sets the train in motion for what we see in the playing poker this episode.
On the river where you used to build the boats.
So after the credits then, we're back in game, and Sunderland, shorn of their talisman, just can't score, can they? No one's turning those Brian Oviedo golden balls into the onion bag. And number nine, Wyke, who was signed in the summer, looks a pretty bad buy. There's lots of misses. You know, Maguire was scoring before. He's not anymore, much to the fans' disdain.
Maguire took the chances. He had one touch the whole of the game. He put the ball in the back of the net. Disappointing.
All is clear, they need a striker. And as Anthony said, there's going to be a lot of office drama here. And Jack Ross says, you know, there's always going to be a difficult position, this one. And McGeady says, you know, as I mentioned a second ago, that there was always going to be a bit of an issue with these guys. But, I mean, losing a talisman, I mean, we know from our FPL experiences that a talisman are really important to clubs. And I think losing talisman is very important. And this isn't an area that Sunderland side eye is new to. So last year, Lewis Graben, who was scoring the goals at the first half of the season in the Championship, obviously moved on in January. And they ended up, you know, Ashley Fletcher, who was a bit rubbish before Josh Maguire rose to fill that sort of position. And now they've found themselves in the same predicament again, haven't they? But yeah, losing a talisman, I guess, is kind of the upshot of what we're seeing here, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course it was going to be a huge loss to them. And you could kind of immediately, that scrappy opening clip that they just showed time after time, where they just didn't have the finisher there. It was very reminiscent to me of when Sean Maguire left Cork City to go to Preston North End halfway through the League of Ireland season in 2017. So this was a player who'd at that point scored 20 goals in 21 games, helping Cork to winning 21 of their first 22 league games that season. Now, what's most striking about it is that in spite of having, you know, a huge amount of points early on in the season, Cork ended up only winning with two games to spare, because Johnny Maguire remained the Golden Boot winner for the whole league, having left with 10 games to go. Cork only won two of their final 10 games, shorn of the striker. And it just shows that when you don't have that finishing touch, it can really just destroy a team. And I think that's what we start to see here.
A cutting head of the snake, isn't it, to some extent?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've seen it as well from an FPL perspective in certain teams, though perhaps when I did some analysis actually of some of the FPL teams, perhaps a Premier League team has a bit more ability to adapt to it. I think a key example perhaps from last season at least was Eden Hazard. He was the, you know, huge absence for Chelsea, at least on the surface, because of the creativity. And when we did our talisman theory, for instance, he was responsible for 158 FPL points, excluding appearances, which was 26.03% of Chelsea's total, which is just absolutely incredible in terms of the impact he had on that season. And just hammering home this point, Pedro apparently was the secondary talisman for that team. And you forget, it's like Pedro was second for points last season for Chelsea. That's incredible. Because this season he's only got a goal and two assists and played eight games. So he's been largely absent too. But with Chelsea, it's, you know, it's not a direct comparison really with Sunderland, because they were able to bring in new players who have emerged, like sort of Mason Mount and Tammy Abraham. They've built their team around new players and they've adapted quite well. And this is based on the underlying stats, for instance. You know, actually with Chelsea, their goal conversions improved from last season, as has their minutes per chance. Not improved by a dramatic amount, but only a slight amount, just indicating that teams can adapt. Perhaps another case would be Spurs. And, you know, last season, Harry Kane was their talisman, and they've struggled since he's been injured in the last eight games, for instance. And with Son, Son's kind of took the mantle for a little bit, at least for the first four games before he got injured as well. So, you know, these clubs do really tend to struggle. A lot of clubs do tend to struggle when a key man goes, a player like Maggio, who's obviously scoring non-stop. And, you know, that's why I guess they had to try and find a replacement, or at least that's what was going through Stuart's head on that deadline day.
It may seem like a ridiculous comparison to make, but I think what's happened to Sunderland here is what happens to almost every football manager who has their striker taken off them when they're managing outside of Europe's top five leagues. It always happens in January that you're left floundering, running through your scout reports, trying to find somebody on a free because you've been screwed over again because some German second-tier team have come in and taken your guy from your Swiss team or whatever you're playing as. It's a struggle.
I know the feeling all too well as the Barnet manager who's just lost Jamie Thomas to a championship club. But yeah, I mean, that sets nicely up the position that we see. Stuart Donald, who's in his office in Oxfordshire, actually, not in Sunderland, he's saying that he's been deceived. He's at the wrong end of a deal. And he says this as well.
I also felt a real determination not to be stitched up again.
Not be stitched up again, eh? Foreshadowing. But he recognises he's now negotiating from a position of weakness. I mean, we see that they're looking for two strikers. He says, we've got to sign two strikers, TC, speaking to Tony Cotton, not Top Cat. First target, John Marquis at Portsmouth, but later found fame on Star Trek Voyager as a rebel cell. Yeah, that doesn't seem like it's gone through. And you see that always wrangling. And I think there is a little bit of a conscious call out to the old-fashioned way. I think this episode and that episode are really related because Stuart and his team have been given the runaround big time, aren't they, by agents here. And as we start to land on Will Grigg, obviously the song, I'm just going to play a little bit of it now. Scoring goals for Wigan. He shows up on Neil Fox's YouTube video. And the fee at the beginning is 2 million. Silly money already. We begin to see it disintegrate as well. Stuart is like petulantly refusing that this is the case. The pressure begins to build. And Stuart starts to take it personally, starts harumphing a little bit. I think we've all been there, haven't we? Working in a time-pressured environment. And the pressure cooker of the deadline day must be absolutely crazy. What sort of experience have we had of working in under those sorts of circumstances?
You must have something, Nick. I only have college essays, and that's nowhere near as interesting.
You've got lots of stuff. Just talk about generalities. You'll be all right.
Obviously, in the workplace environment, you can get caught up in certain projects. Have to work late into evenings. I know one time we couldn't do the pod, I think, because Stag was busy working late in the office, staying there, trying to solve the case, whatever was going on. And I've been in, I've worked overnight before, working on massive projects, and it can be very stressful, and you can see it in Stuart that he is starting to stress out. He's, you know, head in his hands, he's like pacing around, and you can tell as well, Stuart, that like you can tell Will Grigg's his guy, and I feel like he's almost sold the story of the song, the Will Grigg's on fire, you know, sung at the World Cup. Like, Will Grigg was a player my wife had heard of, you know. Eric Cantona, I've been talking about him on the TV and in comedic sketches and stuff like that, and you know, every person at the World Cup was singing that song. So I feel like Stuart's almost believing in that hype, and he's got it in his head. This is the guy he wants, and he's going to get this regardless of whatever financial decisions he's got to make. And you do feel like he does lose his head a little bit in this moment as well.
Absolutely. He starts the train wreck, doesn't he? There's a few back and forth, and there's that really interesting call with Jack Ross, who basically counsels that Will Grigg is not worth the money.
See what the offer you put in? He's not worth any more than that. Not the figures they're talking about, it's just mental. I just wouldn't do it, it's just not worth it. No, fine, okay.
That's categorical, isn't it? Like, remember about foreshadowing. I remember that point for later on, but dear me, I don't think you could put that any more strongly, that he's not worth the money, but or more than the current bid, which I think at this point is about 2 million. I mean, eventually you do see Stuart go in for him again, despite being knocked back and knocked back and knocked back.
What about one more dive in for our main man?
I knew you'd do this.
Up the offer. I knew you would do this.
And he's told, you know, by his guys that his like little cabal that it's his money, but yeah, it doesn't look very good. And the more they look at it, the more they seem to just not be able to conjure up an alternative that have gone too far. It's got to be this guy or nobody. And Tony Cotton says it's like, you know, a dog with a bone.
You want to be a dog with a bone. You don't want to look people up the wrong way.
I know.
You know?
Or give people the message that you're so desperate that they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
This is really like a sunk cost fallacy in humans. And I've spoken about this with regard to FPL a few times, but I guess like behavioral science is crystallizing a situational impact you recognize into a thing. And this is the idea of saying, I've come this far, so I've got to see it through, which I'm sure we've all done in our own lives. And you definitely see that writ large here with Stuart, just kind of thinking, you know what, I'm going to keep going until I get the guy. Transfer deadline day, the madness of a transfer deadline day is definitely a fertile place for that, isn't it? Where you definitely see, you know, transfers being made, players being bought who go on to never play again. Like, you know, Sunderland is a great place to start with examples like that, like Papi Digibodji, who was bought by David Moyes, I think, for $8 million from Chelsea and never played a game. So yeah, maybe a few examples from transfer deadline day which could fit into that.
Yeah, I mean, Sunderland are particularly bad, aren't they? You've obviously, there's so many cases you can think of. The likes of Jermaine Lenz is another one. And obviously, the famous Jack Rodwell, who was on, I think, £75,000 a week in the Championship or something. Absolutely incredible. But yeah, I think with Will Grigg, it is very much foreshadowing with Jack Ross. And I'm glad they had that clip in there where he got told it's not worth it. Because, you know, I was looking at the numbers, to be honest, with Will Grigg. In that season, he'd had 4 goals in 17 appearances. Stuart's talking about signing this 30 goals a season striker who's going to score a hat-trick in the playoff final. But Will Grigg had a record of 4 goals in 17 appearances. That season, he had 4 goals in 18 appearances with League One. So he basically matched his record. So it wasn't even like his form had dropped or anything. But it felt like with Stuart, he lost track of the numbers there.
Yeah, I think he just all rational thought had gone out the window at this point. Like Richard Hill, his colleague, says this.
You fell into the trap of January transfer windows.
And you kind of see Stuart listening to the guys, don't you? But he's kind of detached. He's like a child zoning out when you're being told off.
The calculated judgment you're making is not really very calculated.
Is it not?
Not in my opinion, no. At this point, it doesn't make financial sense, which is all we can judge it on.
And you see this kind of great moment when you see a little smile creep over his face. And it's like a moment of epiphany, that feeling you get before you do something a bit reckless, you know, is a huge gamble. Cinematography here is brilliant, as that moment is interspersed with an insightful voiceover.
I like a deal that makes me feel alive. You know, you can overcomplicate lots of things, but you've just got to go with your gut.
And then that kind of starts this quick sequence of events. You know, he ups the offer to $3 million, less than an hour before the deadline. The offer's up to $3 million, rising to $4 million, a 220% increase on the initial offer. There's fraught scenes. A phone call comes through 5 minutes to go. They've signed it. He says, I'm resigning as chairman next December. As they say, we've got a deal finally. You see Richardson Stewart cuddling on the sofa. He jokes he's not going to have enough to pay the pizza delivery man. He blows out his cheeks and says,
this football club is going to kill me.
And the end slide shows that Grigg is the most expensive signing in League One history. So let's go ahead and deconstruct this huge pivotal moment in the series. Josh Maggio gone, Will Grigg in. What do we make of this?
Jack Ross said that the player wasn't worth £1.25 million. Stuart Donald went on the phone and said to Wigan, £1.25 million, take it or leave it. And he ended up paying up to as far as £4 million for that player. Like, it's absolutely stunning. And I find it quite interesting that he's getting all the advice from everyone around him. He himself knows, and he admits himself that he probably shouldn't have said publicly that they plan to get X numbers of players in, and yet still he allows himself to be effectively exploited by the market around him. And it is kind of that that theory that he thinks that he himself can be the difference for the club, and kind of forgets his position, whereas Jack Ross is kind of worried that he even kind of points out that, you know, he's going to be the one that's judged on this. And we will see later that, it, you know, Donald actually starts to judge Ross on this lapse of his own judgment as well. It's for me, it's a stunning moment because it goes so in the face as well of everything Charlie Methven's been trying to do, which is like scaremongering the staff about cuts, the fact that the club needs to, you know, tighten its belt, cut its cloth. And then suddenly they spunk huge amounts of money, like a huge percentage of their annual revenue on one player who, as Nick said, had scored about as many goals that season as there were millions in his transfer fee.
It's absolutely bonkers. And yeah, I was going to make that point about the last three episodes of all been about, you know, Charlie Methven cutting costs, the piss take party stops now, all of that blab. And it's just like to suddenly say, okay, you know, they've been talking about how they're going to save money, and they're not going to just write a check to make things happen in the same way. And then they go ahead and smash the League One transfer record in January last minute for a player who's not worth the money. As I said, he's only scored four goals so far at that point. You know, one third of what Josh Maggio has scored. It's crazy, isn't it?
I mean, he did score those four goals in the Championship, let's note, and Sunderland are in League One. And he actually does have a very decent record in League One. So the last three seasons he'd played in that division, he'd averaged 21 goals a season. He'd only scored five goals in the Championship between 2016 and 17. But for Wigan in 2017-18, scored 19. 15-16, scored 25. And for Milton Keynes in 14-15, he'd scored 20. So he's definitely a man for whom League One is his level. And I think I can see why he looked at him and thought about that, but I think, as Charlie put it in the clip you heard a little while ago, the club saw him coming, didn't they? And because they knew that they needed a striker. It's like if Man United go out and say, I need a striker, all the agents are going to be quoting 100 million, no matter who the player is, and you end up with Odion Ighalo. A few other views on this as well. So our friend Chris at Awesomeo said basically this, that there's a lack of planning, which ended up in a situation where they were pushed and they basically, you know, they couldn't get Marquee because they wanted 10 million. And Stuart ended up going against, as we documented, the advice of his appointed expert in Jack Ross and paying a lot of money. It's very difficult to be forgiving of Stuart here, isn't it? Like, you know, as you've noted, as like the piss take party, all that sort of rhetoric is completely undermined by the fact that, you know, the non-playing staff now seems to be taking the flak for poor decisions being made in terms of the playing staff. And especially that's true if you think about this episode being juxtaposed with just the last episode where, you know, Sophie Ashcroft, according to the drama at least, had been laid off. So if you think about that and start a contrast with this, them smashing the transfer record, you kind of think, well, yeah, it's one, a very poor business decision. Like, you know, his lackey says exactly that.
At this point, it doesn't make financial sense.
And it's really not, it doesn't like good footballing one either, because the football expert, his in-house football expert, Jack Ross, has said it's not worth it, as Stag mentions.
Not thinking they're talking about it, it's just mental. I just wouldn't.
Yeah, absolutely crazy. I mean, can we even empathise with Stuart here? Can we even recognise the emotions? Because we are looking at it from the cold distance of our sofa, aren't we?
Well, I think the ultimate thing is he made promises. This is how Charlie tries to sell it as well, about you know, them coming to Sunderland, trying to make promises about how, you know, they're going to be signing a player. And essentially, he felt, you know, that he had to deliver on that promise regardless. And if that meant that he was opening his checkbook and spending 3 million, that meant that he was spending that money, his own personal money, because he was looking to make it work at Sunderland. And if he, you know, you saw clips, for instance, about, you know, the Roker report and people saying there was going to be a missed opportunity if they didn't buy anyone in this window, if they blew it, if they didn't find a major replacement, that would be it. They wouldn't be qualifying. You know, they're in a title race. Well, not just a title race, they're in a promotion race here. And it was, you know, promotion was absolutely critical for Sunderland that season to get out of League One as quickly as they could. And losing Maggio meant they had no striker. We saw the clips of Wyke and, you know, not being able to score a goal for love nor money. So they needed someone to come in. And that's I guess, how Stuart was viewing it. He had a promise, he made a promise that he was going to sign a player forward, and he had to deliver on that promise. And unfortunately, yeah, it meant spending a lot of money.
To paint this, though, as the club failing to replace Josh Maggio is kind of to forget that they were going into this window, as they say, looking to pick up two strikers. So maybe they failed to get the marquee player, but they completely forgot, sorry, not trying to make a pun on the other forward, but what they also ended up not doing was getting the substitute for your Maggio if he had stayed, for example. And so they've kind of doubly failed. So kind of tying into Chris's comment that, you know, the club hadn't planned for this from October or November, when they should have been figuring out who even they could get on loan from a Premier League or Championship club in just to have as their second striker. Like, there were options out there for sure. And so it wasn't just a matter of, oh, they thought they could keep Maja and they got caught with their pants down. Well, at the end of the day, what it was just, you know, as Donald himself says, you know, I like a deal that makes me feel alive. And he ended up bidding six times for the same player and effectively making the club a laughingstock.
Yeah, I think it's almost like the gambler's instinct kicked in rather than being a sound business decision. I just think he completely lost all sense of perspective. And as I mentioned earlier, the sunk cost fallacy, that's what kicked in and that's what was driving his decisions at that point. Like, just talk about how Stewart looks when this has been filmed and shown, like how you perceive him as a viewer. Like, I really think it made him look naive. Like, in episode 2, for example, he spoke well about his aims for clubs run the old-fashioned way. But this seems to all be underpinned by a sense of naivety, as far as I'm concerned. And you, even through his actions here, he basically contributes to and becomes complicit in this new money-driven culture that he seems to hate so much. Like, he becomes part of it. He caves epically. And I think that that's kind of an underlying kind of feature of how Stewart comes out of this. He just looks desperate and he looks like an ill-prepared businessman who's made a terrible decision.
I think, obviously, yeah, that is how it looks, and you know that's how it's portrayed on the camera as well. But I think ultimately we do have the benefit of hindsight here, to a certain extent. If it worked out for Will Grigg, if he had netted those 20 goals or whatever, and they had got promoted, you know, top of the division, then perhaps we would be speaking differently right now. I think it's worth highlighting that. No, I tend to agree with both of you in regards to Stewart in these particular scenes.
Oh yeah, no, that's definitely true. And I think that, like, just to bring it to FPL for a second, that other thing that we seem to be known for, if you make a ridiculous call on FPL, so you bring in a 1% owned player and captain him, like, 9 times out of 10, you look like an idiot. But 1 time out of 10, when that comes off and the main captaincy pick fails, you get 80 points and the average is 30, you look an absolute genius. And I think that that's what he was hoping for there. The issue is that if you take out the anecdote and look at it rationally, it's too much of a gamble to make, I think, especially the, you know, the fact he bursts his budget on this guy. As I mentioned, he does have a pedigree there. But as we'll find out a little bit later, he doesn't seem the player who's going to fit in with the system that Jack Ross wants to play. And I think that, more than anything, just shows how naive Stewart is and how much he got wrapped up into that, into the madness of the January transfer window.
He fell into the trap.
Cool. Well, I mean, after this, we're finally out of the office. We've been in the office for a long time. And, you know, we're amongst the fans again. They all seem, funnily enough, satiated by the big money signing of Grigg. Lots of talking heads. And to be honest, the rest of the episode feels an aftershock to this big moment. Charlie, we see him. I think we kind of saw him briefly in Tony Cotton's office, but we see him kind of directly connecting public perception with the signing that's just been made.
In terms of maintaining the trust of the fan base, that we were owners who deliver on what we promise, I think it was really important in that way.
We see Stewart being cuddled in the boozer, fans are appreciative, and they say it's the best piece of transfer business we've seen for a long time.
That's just irritating, isn't it? Because, like, you just know that they're just going to turn on him if it doesn't work out. And, you know, it's just as long as there's someone pouring the money in, they don't care. It's just, you know, Stuart Donald has abandoned his idea of the old way and, you know, a club that's somewhat self-sufficient and all this sort of thing. But the fans as well have completely forgotten everything that they'd been told about trying to have a club that was self-sufficient. And, you know, when the fans are funding the club and it all kind of ties together, it's the club that you own. And now suddenly it's just, no, the big man has just gone and spent big on a player who was unbelievable in League One in 2016 before he went to the Euros and had a song.
Yeah, I mean, this completely erodes all of the setup and all of the high-minded, highfalutin, highly principled stuff that they were saying, right? It just makes me kind of think, you know what? Yeah, people are fickle, aren't they? Just wave a bit of money. Money is the opium of the football fan. And you see it's all Will Grigg being welcomed onto the pitch, don't you? Like, you know, Charlie's proudly next to him. And he also says that he's been treated differently up there in the north.
Some of the Sunderland fans who I've got to know a bit better have said, for Southerners, Stuart and I seem quite down to earth.
I guess they're kind of planting the seed for something in the future there, which we're not going to go into on this pod. Wink, wink. Anyway, the game starts. This is a match with a lovely little reference to episode 1. Nick Barnes starts complaining about how loud the music is ahead of the kickoff. Remember episode 1 when they were talking about the EDM at the beginning?
This is
is how I do it as a DJ, is you've got to try and build people up and you've got to try and get the atmosphere building.
Yeah. And you hear from the man himself, Will Grigg. You have see a Sky Sports interview and you see this fantastic little foreshadow snippet of him in a hotel room setting his target for the season.
My personal target would probably just get to 10 goals and go from there. It's obviously a big ask. 10 in 16 would be a really good return, but it's something that I back myself to do and something that I think the team needs.
Yeah, 10 goals in a half season, I should have said a second ago. Yeah, it's not going to be very good, is it? And you know, we've got this build-up, this excitement to Will Grigg's debut. It's met with failure, isn't it? And there's a procession of games where poor Will Grigg just can't score, can he? You see Jack Ross using the ultimate football manager cliche. He's getting in the right positions, and that's reassuring.
For me, pleased to see him in those positions. Tonight is why we brought him to the club, and he keeps putting himself in those positions, and we keep creating opportunities for him, then he will take.
And we start to hear the first smattering of discontent about Jack Ross, don't we? Like, we go to the Roker report, and yeah, the scenes are rather snaky, aren't they, Stag?
Oh, this is absolutely unbelievable, this particular scene. So we have the host quizzing, first of all, Stuart Donald on the signing and basically how he fits into this system and why they've bought the player in the first place. It's questioning the motivation of the buy, the amount that they've paid, who wanted him first. And this is where we see something really interesting happen. And Stuart Donald, who, having been told by his manager, by Ross, that, you know, 1.25 million is too expensive,
it's just not worth it,
has suddenly started to say that, you know, this was his player. This was the number one transfer target. And now it was up to Jack Ross to make him fit in the team. It's completely throwing him under the bus.
Will Grigg was the number one target that we had in January, and that was Jack's target. I pushed the boat out.
It was, it was pretty dreadful, wasn't it? I mean, we see Graham, the host, he challenges Stuart quite heavily, asking for blame, who's for blame here. And you see Stuart is absolutely rattled, and he basically shafts Jack Ross.
And that was Jack's target.
Kind of saying it was Jack's target. I just paid the bills. It was Jack's target ultimately, and Charlie has to step in, doesn't he? Charlie steps in for the rattle Stuart, saying this is not fair to talk about publicly about employee performances, and puts Graham in his place a little bit, because yeah. We saw the previous times there on the Roker report, it was all very friendly and they're all very nicey, but this time, you know, the critical and challenging questions come on, and I wonder if they'll be back on after that.
Oh, it is barefaced how things change and how Stuart is trying to shift the blame onto Jack Ross, or at least kind of start to cover his back. Plausible deniability for anybody who knows me well. But I mean, if you listen to that with the information that we know about what Jack Ross said on the phone the day they were doing the Will Grigg deal.
Not a chance, not the phone they're talking about.
And you hear those key words, and that was Jack's target.
That was Jack's target.
That's when the blame starts to kind of be apportioned outwards. Like, he had a clear choice there. He could have said, no, this was on me. I went for this. But he chooses not to. He conflates and he blurs the line of responsibility. And he makes it sound like Jack was complicit in the arrival of Grigg, which is simply untrue. It really is quite sinister. I don't know whether it's conscious or if it's unconscious, but it hints at a really kind of conniving side to Stuart, I thought. And that kind of honest, earnest, sort of unassuming image that we've been given to begin with.
Getting involved in Sunderland gave me a chance to run a football club in what I perceive was an old-fashioned way, whereby everyone would feel that they own their football club again.
Really looks like it's being punctured, doesn't it?
It kind of reminds me of a child being scolded by their parent for doing something wrong and turning around and saying, oh, but it was my bigger sister's idea. You know, I didn't want to do it, but they made me do it. You know, I spent all the money just because Jack told me to. Don't blame me. It was unbelievable. So you could see it as sinister, or you could see it as childish, or just, you know, self-defense gone the wrong direction. But it doesn't look good.
No, it certainly does not. Got it.
Yeah, I was just going to reiterate what both of you said. It is a very, very bad moment for Stuart. And yeah, especially with what we've seen of his phone conversation with Jack Ross. you know, it's just shocking, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and the buck should really stop with him, shouldn't it? I mean, I've written on the running order, should the buck stop with him? But I don't even think that's a question. I think that's just a by-the-by thing. I mean, yes, but he's got that convenient lightning rod, hasn't he? And I it's kind of like a Mike Ashley thing at Newcastle, isn't it? Though we'd always blame the manager and use him as a lightning rod to get out of responsibility for himself. Like, I kind of wonder, like, you heard the smatterings of kind of discontent with Jack Ross. I wonder if Stewart had begun to see which way the wind was blowing with Jack and had started to capitalise on that. And again, I personally see parallels with the old-fashioned way and now. Stewart is just falling prey to that culture that he says he doesn't like. You know, the quick win media cycle culture. He's just blaming the manager rather than taking responsibility for himself.
Yeah, and if we bring the episode on just a tickle, you get to Jack Ross in his car and he's talking about, you know, feeling the burn of criticism, but that, you know, if he can't accept that criticism, then the job would swallow him up. And I think what you're actually seeing is that Jack Ross's boss has been swallowed whole and doesn't know how to deal with it. There's a real kind of contrast between them both, because what's so unfair about this is that the fans only saw this as late as we saw it. And no matter what the reports say, and no matter what, unless that Stuart Donald came out himself and took the blame for this, at the end of the day, it's going to be Jack Ross who gets hounded down the sidelines. It's going to be Jack Ross and the players and Will Grigg who's going to get all the pressure from this. And none of them really put themselves in this position. The only, you know, the only people who are coming out of this looking well are Wigan's negotiating team.
Yes, absolutely. It's never the gift horse in the mouth, they say. I don't know why I said horse with a TH there, but we'll go with it. So yeah, I mean, following this little burns, we see Grigg finally scoring. He scores a sympathy penalty, and our pal Luke O'Neill, who we don't really see in this one, gets the FPL assist. And we see him kind of cutely celebrating when he gets a little penalty, and you think, oh, Luke, just want to give him a cuddle. And McGeady explains after the game that he kind of let him have it, and he launched into this kind of little gallant speech actually about how everybody in the club wants him to score and how everybody in the club knows where they need to be.
I want him to score, and I want him to score 20 goals. Everyone inside this club, everyone inside that dressing room knows where we want to be promoted. That's where we want to be. But sometimes you have to be patient. It doesn't all just come at once.
And I just want to digress here with the Irishman. Aidan McGeady, colon, hero. Not a colon hero. Or is he trying to come across as well as he can with him being on a Premier League wage in League One and all that? McGeady's spoken a couple of times in this episode, actually. I think he does actually come across quite well as one of those players that actually does care about the club. He's no longer there, but he's still being paid by Sunderland to this day.
Yeah, it actually strikes me seeing Aidan McGeady taking on this guy's, because I think for years he was just, I guess, just because of the style of player he is and the nomadic career that he's had, where often he's been cast aside at big clubs and gets another big move somewhere else. I guess because of his performances for Ireland as well, where he kind of comes off the bench and does a few twists and flickers, but often actually gets nowhere. He's not the sort of player you perceive as having this leadership ability, the kind of the noose or the bravery to kind of come forward and to stand up for somebody and even to give away a ball, to give a sympathetic penalty as well, as you say, to bring the striker into things. It's a totally different side of Aidan McGeady, and I think he comes out of this looking quite well, and he's clearly giving his all for the club, as you say, Tom, but also on the pitch he's delivering the performances, and obviously matching his wage is very difficult to do, but at the same time he's definitely doing his bit.
Yeah, exactly. I think he's certainly one of the heroes of the episode, and he came across very honourable in letting Will Grigg take that penalty and, you know, helping restore his confidence, hoping that he would go on a winning run and scoring run, because, you know, ultimately Will Grigg's you know, pivotal part of that team, especially with the money spent on him. And McGeady comes across well here.
Cool. Well, after helping Will Grigg score one of only four goals this season, we move on to the end of the episode. So as the episode closes, we see Stewart reflecting on the events of this episode. He spent above budget and he lays bare, as we saw in this, I think, episode one, of the difference, the amount of money he's going to spend to keep Sunderland in League One.
You know, if we don't go up, Sunderland Football Club's going to cost £25 million to run in League One. What we don't want to do is go down that route, risk not having enough money to see it through properly.
And there's that auspicious ending. And we spoke about it a few episodes ago in terms of not overstaying your welcome. And he was saying, you know, I'm starting to think about that right now. Yeah. So how has this episode, now it's all tied up, shifted our perceptions of Stuart, guys?
So actually in that closing scene, we see Stuart Donald talking about how he feels that he, as the management of the club, needs time. And also that Jack Ross may need time. But now he's talking about the idea that they may not develop the club as fast as the fans expect. I almost feel like he's actually farming out the blame just that little bit further for the whole entire Will Grigg thing, and the fact that because the club have spent so much money, the expectations grow of fans. And I think he's blaming the fans for expecting something from Will Grigg, who he says is at the club because he's blaming Jack Ross for it, when at the end of the day, the buck should have stopped with him for this. And so he comes across as naive in one sense, because I don't think he fully gets it, and conniving in another is, it's a harsh way of looking at it. But at the same time, your perception of Stuart Donald completely changes. He no longer seems like the kind of affable kind of a man who kind of expects to be able to change football in his own minor way as a custodian of the club that's going to get out of the way. He now suddenly just seems like another man throwing money at it because he's trying to chase his ego.
Yeah, I mean, is he a noble man just caught up in everything, or is that what he's like anyway? Like, to what extent is the system to blame, and to what extent is he to blame as a person?
The system that is football, I presume you mean in that.
Yeah.
I think he's not the first person to fall victim of it, and I think, you know, everyone can attest to at some point or another kind of just falling prey to getting into the moment and just chasing something, and maybe making, you know, you might be just buying something random in IKEA because you just happen to have the money to spare, but it's still blowing your budget or just forgetting what's your means for just a minute, gambling too much of the horses. I don't know.
Exactly, and I think ultimately his reputation will have been damaged by this incident, because Wigan has played him like a kipper with this particular transfer window. And you have to remember, this is essentially his first transfer window, his first deadline day. And, you know, other clubs will take notes and think, oh, new Sunderland owner, oh, he's not afraid to be opening his wallet. Perhaps if we reject the first deal, they'll come back and offer us twice again, because, you know, now a precedent has been set in how Stuart, you know, other clubs will expect Stuart to treat transfer windows when they're purchasing players. So I think, you know, it's very negative for him, because I don't even know if he can, I don't know how much money he's got available. Or, you know, he talks about how, you know, the whole idea was they're going to try and turn it into profit-making business, and he's thrown out completely to the wolves. And can he afford even to open his checkbook again, especially if they're stuck in the doldrums of League One, where there's not much money to be made?
It goes back to what's happened to Manchester United under Ed Woodward, that it's taken years to rehabilitate the club in transfer negotiations after Ed Woodward got played like a kipper, to use Nick's simile. You know, I think twice or three times before Woodward really kind of copped on and kind of understood how to play the market, and maybe United got in a position where they no longer looked as desperate in so many positions like Sunderland did with just the striker position in this transfer market. As you say, it is how other clubs are going to view them, that, you know, if you reject them and they need a player, they're going to come back. They're not going to hold for it. They're not going to gamble on their academy. They're not going to resourcefully find some loan player or some French player that they can just bring in to replace them. They just didn't have that news.
No, certainly not. And I think it just, for whatever reason, it just doesn't look that good. And with Stuart himself, I mean, he doesn't, I've had a little look into the financials at Bridal Insurance, who is the company that he owned and then sold on. He sold it on to another big conglomerate, and, you know, it's a bit boring, but yeah, it's about £10 million is what they've got under management. Gross written premium, that is, and 17 people, including Neil Fox, who moved to Finch Group, who is one of the lackeys that you see in this episode. So Stuart isn't actually the richest man in the world. Yeah, okay, but I mean, he's richer than we'd all want the amount of money he's got in the bank, no doubt. But he's not a sugar daddy to any extent. I think you're probably looking at one-digit millions, not tens of millions. He's not really a multi-millionaire in the kind of sense that we want him to be. He's just made quite a big gamble to buy this club. And it looks like from the background as well that I've read, like, he initially was going to go in as part of a consortium for lots of people and end up just buying the club outright, which again kind of points to a bit of a gambler rather than there being a bit of a bit of nous behind it. I don't know. I just think this episode really challenges and in some ways erodes that sort of whiter than white idealized paragon image he was trying to give. And it kind of feels like a bit of a build them up, tear them down, doesn't it, this episode? Because I guess if you are just an audience member who's breezing through the episodes, I mean, this one just really just destroys his reputation, I guess, or the way in which he has been perceived previously.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I think, you know, in the first three episodes, the jury was out. I wouldn't have necessarily said he came across like a paragon. I would certainly say the jury was out. We'll see what happens with this guy, how he can develop, whether they can deliver on the promises, and certainly the promises that Charlie was making quite intensely over the last few episodes to both the staff and the public. And yeah, it's just clearly this episode everything is starting to unravel. We can see the blame game starting to build up, and I think certainly the blame game is going to be a heavy feature of the next couple of episodes as well.
Well, I think it was more of a, like the way he was projecting himself as a paragon rather than him being a paragon himself, if that makes sense. The projection of the self. But yeah, no, very interesting. But at least we completely forgot about Josh Marger, eh? That feels like a long time ago now, doesn't
Marger.
It? Exactly, Marger, making it tougher.
Marger.
So, dominated by office drama. Did we like this episode, guys?
Yeah, I think it was absolutely brilliant. It actually reminded me of, in the lead series, the episode with Daniel James. It's kind of a contrast to that, in that they actually get the player at the end. You'll remember Daniel James was actually at Leeds and didn't sign for the club in that particular episode. And so you saw a totally different side of the frustration that comes in boardrooms. Whereas here you probably saw Leeds look like they were getting a good deal. And certainly with hindsight, it looks like a brilliant deal that they were going to get for him then, whereas here, you know, obviously hindsight poisons the view of it, and you know, there was that whole 1 in 10 or 1 in 100 chance that this is going to prove to be a great deal, even at £3 to 4 million. But it's amazing to watch. I think the frustration, the ignoring advice, everything that goes, it's not what you see usually as a football fan, and I think that's what a fly in the wall documentary like this offers, and I think that's what's brilliant about it.
I think, yeah, it's really, really interesting. I think we've all probably stayed up watching Sky Sports News on deadline day between 10 and midnight, thinking, is anything actually going to happen? You know, why am I wasting my evening watching this when nothing's actually happening? But it's quite interesting to see the other side of the coin. You know, the men in the boardrooms, they're sitting there, they're on their phones, they're trying to make deals, they're, you know, panicking. I mean, yeah, the good Daniel James comparison is very interesting as well, because obviously I'm thinking that one, Swansea went missing and they just couldn't get hold of Swansea at all, regardless. And the player was there, he's essentially signed all the paperwork, had his medical, done everything, and they couldn't get it over the line because the other team had just gone completely AWOL. And, you know, that was very frustrating for Leeds. And in this scenario, it's kind of very different. You don't know what's going on. Wigan's side with the thing, he's back, he's asked again, more money, what's going on, you know, like, or are they just like knowing that they're playing him deliberately like a kipper? Because there's, you know, there's no real phone calls, it's all through agents, it's all through third parties, and that's just the complicated. I think it's all via faxes as well for some reason. Obviously you've got famous David De Gea signing for Real Madrid, missing fax saga and stuff. And so yeah, it's really interesting to watch.
I also enjoy in this episode the fact that we explore so many different ways of expressing your exasperation in the English language. I think it's like, if you were a non-native English speaker, this was the episode to watch if you wanted to kind of get some vocab for going into an office in the future. It was ridiculous. They kept saying it in different ways. I found that pretty funny.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, very episode dominated by harumphing and face palming and sighing and exclaiming your disregard for the other person, right? I did really like this episode. I think fundamentally what's incredible about the way it's shot and the way it's presented is that it's again made a load of people in an office just talking about stuff. Very, very interesting. That's one hell of an achievement, isn't it? Like, if they came into our offices during normal times, it would not be interesting at all. It'd be loads of people talking about stuff which was not interesting. But for this particular episode, it was absolutely fascinating. And there was no real kind of Luke 09 moment like in the last episode where you've got at least some sort of light relief from it. It was all proper heavy stuff. And it was all sort of perceptual as well, because you saw it happening to them. You saw it happening to Stuart. You saw him change. You saw him morph before your very eyes. But it all kind of happened in a very sort of mundane way when you think about it, didn't it? It didn't happen in sort of some weird kind of horrible metamorphosis. You saw him kind of just driven by sweets and Lucozade, change into an irrational monster. And I thought that was absolutely brilliantly done. And I'm guessing, you know, as I said, after that point, our episode felt like a bit of an aftershock. But I mean, the blame game already starting, as Nick mentioned, is definitely going to be something which is going to be worth watching as this sort of continues, isn't it? Cool. All right. Well, anything else to mention on this? Crack through that.
Yeah, that was remarkably quick.
Yeah. No, Nick's just touching his beard. All right. What are you going to do about your beard, Nick?
Go at some point. It's all going to go. I think my hair as well.
I think you can donate that to places as a flood relief. Yeah, if you put it in tights, if you put beard hair in tights, it's like waterproof as well. It's like putting a sandbag down.
Well, if I get my hair cut in the garden, the birds might use it to make the nests.
I was thinking hedgehog houses, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm gonna go the whole way.
Raise some money for the NHS or something.
I'm probably going to go the whole way on the hair front anyway and let it grow longer for a while. I've got at least another 3 weeks here before hairdressers are open, so might be able to go man bun just for one episode.
Oh my. Yeah, I've got a little while. I don't know what I'd do. I'll probably just get Sarah to cut it for me.
Me?
No. I told you, it's as far as it goes. So it just took a bit of shit. No. Mm-hmm. It doesn't fill out. So it just ends up looking, it's a lot of hair, it's a bit hairy if you go close to it, but there's a whole area that's just bald and the hair will never grow there. It's depressing, isn't it? Who's going to say just to say?
I haven't done it in ages. I don't think I've done it since then. And with that, we've reached the end of this particular watch along, and we'll be looking forward to coming back for episode 5 next week. But in the meantime, just to say, we are, of course, Who Got the Assist. You'll find us on Twitter at WGTA_FPL or WGTA_Nick for Nick, or you'll find me, FPL Stag, at FPL Stag. We're also on Instagram as well at WGTA.FPL.
Yep, and as Stag said, we'll be back next week to talk about season 2, episode 5, and it's titled A Time for Men.
Yeah, definitely have the beers to fulfill that manliness, don't we?
We will do indeed. Unless it all goes between this time, unless I have a sort of a Stuart Donald's infused midnight breakdown and just shave my entire head.
Like Marshall is wedding helmet mother. All right, well, stay safe, everyone. I hope to see you watch Sunday Until I Die, and we'll be back very, very soon. Bye.
It's Lon.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.